This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is The Money. Today, how the pandemic's changing what we buy, especially what we buy to eat, even how we think about shopping. Let's begin with housing. Before the budget, you'll remember, most economists were telling the government that putting money into social and affordable housing would provide the best bang for the buck. It keeps construction going and adds much-needed social infrastructure. The newly formed National Affordable Housing Alliance wants to get a lot more to happen in this space. It's a group of unions, construction industry bodies, ACOS, industry super, and social groups. It's chaired by Rod Fearing.
Well, it's a common interest between each of those groups. Their interests are slightly different, but the common interest is to ensure that if we're going to invest in infrastructure in this country at this particular time to stimulate the economy, then a real legacy needs to be generated as a consequence. It's an alliance around a common interest. So our focus is not so much to be an advocate on behalf of everyone, because everyone's got their own nuanced approach on these issues, and they are complex issues. Our approach is to spend our time, effort, and collective intelligence, hopefully that's greater than the sum of the parts, to focus on the development of policy options that can be played out in each state and to meet needs that are not all homogeneous, that to meet needs that are nuanced and more specific. There is obviously the disability housing component, which is being looked after through the NDIS component, and the federal government's approach in underwriting or guaranteeing, if you like, the NDIS's commitment to those 400,000 recipients of housing is an important step forward. But that then it moves us to those people in desperate need, which is where state governments have been directing what housing they can produce to service the needs of those people who are in grave difficulties in meeting their needs for secure and affordable housing. But then you've got other dimensions of that, well, key worker housing. You've got the need for to bolster, if you like, an ongoing program of public housing to meet growing waiting lists.
So there's actually lots of different parts to this.
Exactly.
Are you what, to try to come up with ideas and solutions and then what, go to the different levels of government and say, here, we're going to connect this idea with this funding?
It's really about the connecting the idea, connecting the existing incentives that exist, connecting the capabilities of organisations who are already doing things in small ways, pulling those together into sort of a coherent policy framework, if you like, so that we can start to get, if you like, some commonality of approaches across the country, so that you can then start to scale those things that work really well and can be scaled, and not fragment the effort, if you like, which when you look across the spectrum of the housing solutions that are being provided, you've got shared equity schemes that have worked really well in WA, which are state-based initiatives. You've got NIFIC, which is a federal initiative, which is now gathering getting itself organised, if you like, in terms of what it's capable of doing. Then you've got the state initiatives in the social housing side of things in Victoria and New South Wales. Then you've got, you know, opportunities around maybe built to rent has a role to play. I suspect not, to be honest. It's a different segment of the mainstream market, I think, but there's got a ways to go before it becomes real. Then we've got other initiatives in the planning system with inclusionary zoning, and then we've got the initiatives that individual superannuation funds like First State Super, CBUS, etc. have done different things and are making commitments to, particularly in the key worker housing sector or segment of this need. So when you add all of those things up, no one really knows what the total commitment towards addressing affordable, rental, secure housing and public housing actually translates into in terms of numbers, and whether it's repeatable year on year on year rather than sort of at a particular point in time.
Rod, that's a bewildering array of ideas. I suspect most people listening now would not have known about all of those. But do we know that shortfall?
Yeah. I'm sorry. It is a bit bewildering, and that's half the problem. But it's in the order of, and it depends on which part of the spectrum you're talking about. From a social housing point of view, it's somewhere around 400,000 in terms of a shortfall. That will grow over a period of time unless we do something to start to increase the supply of social and public housing I'm talking about there. And affordable housing, which is in that sort of, it's not for the destitute, but it's for those people who are finding it hard to stay in the housing market, suffering significant housing stress, and yet they're performing essential services. So your key workers are a part of that, plus people who are falling out of relationships, and women supporting families are finding it very, very difficult to sustain quality, stable housing in circumstances where they really don't have anything to fall back on. And that's where I think this, and the sort of shortfall we're talking about in that affordable rental housing, is in the order of a couple of 100,000 as well, and growing. And then you've got on top of that key workers too, which are a much more, a smaller segment of the market, but need to be quite specifically targeted.
The need is real, and you're underlining that with numbers that I don't think I'd got my head around before. But before the last budget, any number of economists were saying what the government, the federal government, should do is spend money on social and affordable housing. We didn't get any of it. Is there a reason why that didn't happen?
Well, the primary reason, I think, and unfortunately I've been hearing the same outcomes for the last a few decades now, but the primary reason is that the delivery of public housing and the delivery of major housing initiatives rests with the states. Now, the federal government has a role to play, absolutely no doubt about that. But if we keep focusing on the federal government, who believe it's a state problem to focus on, then we need to not keep repeating the same story, if you like, expecting a different outcome. I think we need to embrace the fact that the states are, the engine room of a response in this regard. And the states are all a little bit different in how they go about it. And so we've got to be smart enough to be able to tailor common interests and weave them into a policy set of policy outcomes that can be embraced by state governments and local governments, utilising and maybe hypothecating some of their tax bases to enable this to happen. But more importantly, that is only, if you like, the seed or the incentive to then start to attract private capital and capital markets into this space in a way that is not just putting its hand out for a subsidy, but is looking for a way to actually scale the delivery overall so that we get year-on-year contributions. And if when we're doing that, we're starting to talk about all sorts of other things, some of which the states have got control of, but some of which the federal government has control of. But if we've got this coalition of interests and a succinct and consistent policy base and an ability to be able to scale it with capital support, then you can go to the Commonwealth government and say, well, look, we need some changes here and here. That's what we would now like to talk to you about, instead of why don't you just sort of open up the coffers and solve the problem for everyone with a river of cash. I mean, the reality is that just won't happen.
Rod, good luck with it. And thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you very much.
Rod Fairings, the chair of the National Affordable Housing Alliance. This is The Money on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. So now it's timber. That's the latest Australian export to be banned by China. Chinese Customs says pests were found in shipments of logs from Victoria and it's banning them. Wood joins barley, beef, wine, rock lobster, sugar, I think that's it, in the dock for one reason or another. Coincidentally, this is after China made its displeasure known at Australia's call for an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic earlier this year. Jane Gollies, the director of the Australian Centre on China in the World at the ANU.
We can track, and I have tracked over time, how the political relationship between Australia and China has affected our exports to China. And over the period 1998 to about 2013, it looks like there's no relationship at all. So even when there are political problems, and there always are between any two countries, there seems to be a resilience to trade. But I think that story's shifted in recent years. You know, as everyone knows, we have a dependency on China, or a vulnerability, a sensitivity, because they're such an important export market for us and we're not equally as important to them, and add to that their economic power, and we start to see much more possibility and also the use of these sort of punishment strategies, if they so choose.
They seem to be choosing so at the moment. And as Tim Hunt from Rabobank points out, they're targeting a success story.
Agriculture has become increasingly reliant on China in the last decade, primarily due to our great success at developing and opening that market and the value they've placed on what we produce, its safety, its provenance and quality. So in the last decade, our exports to China in food and ag have increased from about $2 billion to around $12 billion today. And as we stand, account for almost one in every three products we export.
It seems like an obvious question, but why is China choosing these particular sectors to target, to hold things up? Do they share any characteristics?
They do, and it's a very pertinent question. And China has often chosen agriculture in the past to send signals to countries that appear to be disagreeing with their policies in a public forum. Firstly, they pick products they can do without. Secondarily, they pick products that I think are high profile. And thirdly, products that are produced by a number of people and hence are impacting voters in that market.
So either they can source them from somewhere else, or they decide they can live without them temporarily, and it's going to generate a kind of political reaction.
That's right. And that dispensability of Australian products into China, again, is part of our success story. The US, for example, tends to send a lot lower value commoditized soybean, corn into that marketplace. We've always focused as an industry sending in high quality wines, rock lobsters that trade at an extraordinary premium, high value provenance, infant formula and dairy. The upside of that is it's been extraordinarily valuable. The downside is very little of it is required by their citizens when push comes to shove, if they want to do without it.
Right. The other part of that is that there's no hold up on Australian iron ore or Australian metallurgical coal.
That's correct. And again, this is a pattern we've seen over the last decade or so. There've been at least six countries where China has seen political tensions rise, has cracked down on one or two trade products, but continued to buy other things. They cracked down on Vietnamese lychees, still imported their seafood and rubber. They made it difficult for Canada to ship in canola and meat, still bought their wheat. So it is unusual for China to ban everything, and even the scope of products rumoured to be under consideration from Australian agriculture is extremely broad.
So can we definitely say this is all about pulling Australia into line?
You've got to be really careful, I think, to call it economic coercion, because they do have other stories that make that coercion story what we call plausibly deniable. You know, and so, for example, in the barley story from this year, it wasn't just out of the blue that they just decided to punish us on the back of the COVID inquiry. In fact, that was an 18-month-long investigation into anti-dumping. And there's an even bigger story behind that. I heard just yesterday that I think in the last 5 or maybe 10 years, Australia has launched 70 anti-dumping cases against China. I might have that number wrong, but it's in that ballpark, whilst China has launched 6 at us in return. But bring it forward to just last week, you know, with the what we think will be bans, it's all not completely obvious at this point, but on wine, barley, timber, coal, lobster, sugar, you know, the list goes on and on. It's not looking possible that they can continue to deny that this isn't a punishment strategy. And they've been pretty clear about that this year. And it's got a lot to do with our alliance with the United States, but also to do with how we have responded to them throughout this year. You know, it takes two to tango there.
I have been struck by the kind of power of uncertainty and ambiguity in all this, because certainly with some of the latest things about, for example, rock lobster, there has been verbal communication, but nothing that anyone can say, well, here it is written down. It's fuzzy.
Yes, and I think they're being probably deliberately fuzzy. And, you know, I say that because the state media this week, they were the ones who announced that there were going to be these bans in place. And then a number of Chinese officials deny that that's the case. And yet state media doesn't usually print things that the top leadership would be unhappy with. And so you would think that they all know exactly what's going on and that they're, I guess, enjoying to some extent, or at least playing some sort of game in keeping us on our toes. I mean, and that there's a signal there in itself.
Well, yes. And for the industries affected, it's a blow.
We have to be honest and note that China is a very difficult and nigh on impossible market to replicate. So it's not our first choice to expand into other markets, but having a good spread of markets is important. So from a risk perspective, that makes sense. And we are fortunate to have other options. The market's going to vary sector to sector. In products like barley, the industry has proved pretty adept at placing product we would have sent to China into markets like Southeast Asia and the Middle East. In beef, any hit from China so far has largely been offset by the strong demand for our product going into American fast food chains. And in cotton, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Indonesia are taking product at the moment. So there are other markets, many of them on our doorstep, some of them further afield, but we're fortunate to have alternatives that we can work on developing in coming years.
Speaking of which, the coming years look pretty good for China.
There's really only one way to put this, and it's that the Chinese economy is going to record the strongest growth in the world this year. And those numbers have been upgraded significantly from the beginning of the year. So the IMF put out its World Economic Outlook in October and has projected that China will grow at 1.9% GDP growth this year. And just to put one big comparison out there is India, that is now projected to contract by minus 10.3%. And in fact, the whole global economy is contracting by minus 4.4%. The only country that's bringing anything into the positive zone is the Chinese economy. So, you know, this raises really contentious and important questions about how the Chinese government has restarted growth, about the roles of the private and state sectors in the Chinese economy. And I think it's hard to deny that they've done pretty well this year. And looking forward, you know, again, all sorts of risks that could slow them down, but nothing's going to slow them down to the pace of India's growth in the years ahead.
So, of course, we've got this issue with barley and wine and beef and lobster and sugar and copper and timber. I think that's all of them at the moment. There must be some concern about what might be next.
Well, the concern about what might be next, but that's in terms of what is actually enacted. We have to note that barley is one where there's absolutely anti-dumping duties in place. They've doubled up by banning certain exporters, and that appears to be precluded from China at the moment. In wine, they are still undergoing an investigation that may see us priced out of their market through further anti-dumping duties. That is not concluded yet. And a lot of this discussion of sugar, which, by the way, is only minimal amounts goes to China, but other products like beef, sheep, meat, wool, that at times have been rumoured. They are still rumours. But yes, there is a range of things on the table. We can't preclude that more won't be added, although I would reference the fact that historically China has chosen a few commodity lines when looking to deliver a message to other countries. And it's not impossible, but it would be unusual for them to look to preclude all Australian food and ag products from their market.
Let's hope it doesn't get too unusual. There's something else, though, something more structural, and it's likely to affect what China wants to buy from other countries, including us. It's called dual circulation.
So dual circulation, I will call Xi's solution to a whole bunch of challenges that it's facing, but primarily the antagonism with the United States and that continuing trade war. Essentially, it's about making the domestic economy the mainstay of economic growth for China. So they're starting to use words again that were familiar back in the Maoist era of self-reliance. But with a modern touch, innovation and technology are absolutely fundamental to this pitch. And they're, you know, for example, pushing for technology technological self-sufficiency by 2035. So they're going to use a whole bunch of industrial policy tools to achieve that goal. And then the second part of the circle, or the other circle, is the global economy. And they're talking about different ways of continuing to connect into the global economy. So, for example, you'll see more trade and investment flows, I think, with Belt and Road countries and less with those countries that it perceives to be unfriendly. So that does have implications for Australia, not all negative. One other key prong of the dual circulation strategy is green growth. They're absolutely committed to that. They're also committed to, you know, the Paris Agreement and to playing a sort of globally positive role there. And combined with some capital market opening into China, I think there'll be new opportunities for Australian companies to invest in green sectors, for example, on Chinese turf.
Jane Golly from the ANU, and before her, Tim Hunt from Rabobank. This is The Money on RN and everywhere good podcasts are downloadable. I'm Richard Adie. There's so much we still don't know about how we're being affected by the pandemic. Obviously, there's health and the economy, there's how we work. And McKinsey, the consultancy, says it's also reshaping our emotional needs, specifically when it comes to what we buy. Jenny Child, who's a partner at McKinsey, says consumption can feel like control. But what does that mean?
This is, and it's a really complicated topic, because in some ways, consumption is the one thing that we can still hang on to. I can still get online and buy a shirt, right? I can still decide where I'm going to buy my groceries from. And while it seems like this pre-COVID maybe micro decision in life, it's been elevated as something that consumers feel like they can really control. And so we see them reasserting a mindfulness to that decision-making process around consumption that is different than pre-COVID.
Well, how is it different?
It's different because we see, back to that point around values coming to the forefront in people's lives and reconnecting with some of the things that are important. One facet, for instance, we see is this idea of supporting local neighborhoods and the localness of what I'm buying, both from a provenance perspective, but also just that community support. We see that coming up as a decision-making factor and staying topical despite, you know, we're hitting a recessionary time, and also price and what I'm buying in terms of value is important. So that control of, depending on what I'm buying, I get to exercise that hierarchy of what I'm really optimizing for. Is it sustainability? Is it localness? Is it price?
So price, I imagine that earlier on in this process would have loomed larger, but it's still here, right?
Yes. Price matters. Price matters. We'll be going through a period of time where we'll see a spike in people paying more and more attention to price. And we've already seen that in our data. The seven touch points we've seen a steady increase in the number of consumers saying, I'm paying more attention to prices when I'm shopping. I'm looking more for promotions. And depending on the segment of consumer, that can be anywhere near 60% of them saying they're doing that, more than pre-COVID.
So price, and you mentioned people wanting to support local products, either that's the provenance of the product or where they buy it. Are other things coming through as well?
Yes, and I should mention, Richard, that looking in aggregate at what consumers are telling us is less helpful than thinking about them in segments, because some of what they're telling us in this question that you're asking right now is, you know, what are the other buying factors that seem to be rising to the top or getting more attention? There are big differences with a segment of consumers, let's just say, who have lost income during COVID, right? So the way that they respond to the questions obviously is clearly different to another segment of respondents who are more stable and secure during this period up to this point. But that said, we still see about a quarter, 25% of Australians in both of those segments actually saying sustainability and finding sustainable solutions in the things that they're buying is more important than it was pre-COVID.
I'm struck by the kind of different forces pushing in actually sort of slightly different directions. If we're concerned about price, and we are, but we're also wanting to support local products and communities, we're paying attention to things like sustainability, we're being pushed in different directions. It's very human.
It is. It's very human, and I think it can also be confusing, certainly for our clients who are thinking about, what do I optimize for? Do I optimize for that localness? Do I optimize for value? And the truth of it is, I think some really great examples of where you see multiple factors being accomplished in one product or one offer are where it ultimately will go. It's not a zero-sum game. So in some cases, you'll see value and sustainability coming up in the same offer. And their organic range, I think, is a great example of that. We also use the example of Tim Tams, which is a very value-based product, but also 100% locally manufactured and a brand that people have loved for a long time. So you can actually meet two of these factors, while they might feel quite opposing, in the same offer. It's possible.
You just made a lot of people pay a bit more attention when you drop the Tim Tam bomb in there.
I know, it's a well-loved trend. Yeah. We saw a big spike in Tim Tam.
And now people are saying, and you know what, McKinsey is saying, it's okay, I'm going to have another one. I am struck by though this because I think the technical term or the term that's used is barbelling. You're attracted to products at sort of one end of a range and also different products perhaps at a different end of the range. And there's a kind of tension. I don't know whether we're navigating that tension automatically because normally when we go to the shops, we sort of have a list. Sometimes I actually write things down, sometimes I don't, and I kind of know what to do. But from what you're saying, that routine has been challenged by what we've been going through.
The routine in terms of I'm on autopilot is what we think has really been disrupted. The people are off autopilot. And so if we take the shopping example, the idea of I'm planning for my weekly shop again, which is a trend that we saw going in the opposite direction pre-COVID. There was a lot more I'm going to buy what I need real time that night or a day before. We've seen that sort of reemergence of the weekly shop. And I do think in any environment where a consumer is going in with a mindset about what it is I need for my household, they still can be inspired, right? They still can be inspired by something that's in front of them that says, oh yeah, I am really trying to buy more sustainable things. And this is a pretty good value. So I'm going to try that this time. We see lots of new trials happening during COVID. Of new brands, of small brands. There's a real uptick in that.
What about this? And of course, this has been very marked in Victoria, where we've gotten used to not going out as much, but we've been more at home. Has that been something that's come through as well?
The number one question we get asked is, what of these behavior changes are going to be sticky? And this nesting at home one, I think, comes to the top. We don't have a crystal ball. No one has a crystal ball. But one of the resets that has happened by force, really, because of regulations and what we're told to do, is this nesting at home element. The home as an occasion reemerging as something that people really value and treasure and want to continue in some facet. That might mean a 10 to 20% swing versus what we've seen during lockdowns, which has really been 100% swing. But that's still meaningful. It's certainly meaningful to the hospitality sector.
It really is. That is Jenny Charge. She's a partner at McKinsey. And that's it for the show this week. The Money is produced by Belinda Sommer. Our sound engineer is Wayne Ewan. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.